Chapter 2. The sun brought all the sick people out of their berths this morning, and the indescribable moans and noises which had been issuing from behind the fine painted doors on each side of the cabin happily ceased. Long before sunrise, I had the good fortune to discover that it was no longer necessary to maintain the horizontal posture, and, the very instant this truth was apparent, came on deck, at 2 o'clock in the morning, to see a noble full moon sinking westward, and millions of the most brilliant stars shining overhead. The night was so serenely pure that you saw them in magnificent airy perspective, the blue sky around and over them, and other more distant orbs sparkling above, till they glittered away faintly into the immeasurable distance. The ship went rolling over a heavy, sweltering, calm sea. The breeze was a warm and soft one, quite different to the rigid air we had left behind us, 2 days since, off the Isle of Wight. The bell kept tolling its half hours, and the mate explained the mystery of watch and dog watch. The sight of that noble scene cured all the woes and discomfitures of seasickness at once, and if there were any need to communicate such secrets to the public, one might tell of much more good that the pleasant morning watch effected. But there are a set of emotions about which a man had best be shy of talking lightly, and the feelings excited by contemplating this vast, magnificent, harmonious nature are among these. The view of it inspires a delight and ecstasy which is not only hard to describe, but which has something secret in it that a man should not utter loudly. Hope, memory, humility, tender yearnings towards dear friends, and inexpressible love and reverence towards the power which created the infinite universe blazing above eternally, and the vast ocean shining and rolling around fill the heart with a solemn humble happiness that a person dwelling in a city has rarely occasion to enjoy. They are coming away from London parties at this time. The dear little eyes are closed in sleep under mother's wing. How far off city cares and pleasures appear to be, how small and mean they seem, dwindling out of sight before this magnificent brightness of nature. But the best thoughts only grow and strengthen under it. Heaven shines above, and the humble spirit looks up reverently towards that boundless aspect of wisdom and beauty. You are at home, and with all at rest there, however far away they may be, and through the distance the heart broods over them, bright and wakeful like yonder peaceful stars overhead. The day was as fine and calm as the night. At 7 bells, suddenly a bell began to toll very much like that of a country church, and on going on deck we found an awning raised, a desk with a flag flung over it close to the compass, and the ship's company and passengers assembled there to hear the captain read the service in a manly respectful voice. This, too, was a novel and touching sight to me. Peaked ridges of purple mountains rose to the left of the ship, Finisterre and the coast of Galicia. The sky above was cloudless and shining, the vast dark ocean smiled peacefully round about, and the ship went rolling over it, as the people within were praising the maker of all. In honor of the day, it was announced that the passengers would be regaled with champagne at dinner, and accordingly that exhilarating liquor was served out in decent profusion, the company drinking the captain's health with the customary orations of compliment and acknowledgement. This feast was scarcely ended when we found ourselves rounding the headland in Tuvigo Bay, passing a grim and tall island of rocky mountains which lies in the center of the bay. Whether it is that the sight of land is always welcome to weary mariners, after the perils and annoyances of a voyage of 3 days, or whether the place is in itself extraordinarily beautiful, need not be argued. But I have seldom seen anything more charming than the amphitheater of noble hills into which the ship now came. All the features of the landscape, being lighted up with a wonderful clearness of air, which rarely adorns a view in our country. The sun had not yet set, but over the town and lofty rocky castle of Vigo a great ghost of a moon was faintly visible, which blazed out brighter and brighter as the superior luminary retired behind the purple mountains of the headland to rest. Before the general background of waving heights which encompassed the bay, rose a second semicircle of undulating hills, as cheerful and green as the mountains behind them were gray and solemn. Farms and gardens, convent towers, white villages and churches, and buildings that no doubt were hermitages once, upon the sharp peaks of the hills, shone brightly in the sun. The sight was delightfully cheerful, animated, and pleasing. Presently the captain roared out the magic words, "Stop her!" And the obedient vessel came to a standstill, at some 300 yards from the little town, with its white houses clambering up a rock, defended by the superior mountain whereon the castle stands. Numbers of people, arrayed in various brilliant colors of red, were standing on the sand close by the tumbling, shining, purple waves. And there we beheld, for the first time, the royal red and yellow standard of Spain floating on its own ground, under the guardianship of a light blue sentinel, whose musket glittered in the sun. Numerous boats were seen, incontinently, to put off from the little shore. And now our attention was withdrawn from the land to a sight of great splendor on board. This was Lieutenant Bundy, the guardian of Her Majesty's mails, who issued from his cabin in his long swallow-tailed coat with anchor buttons, his saber clattering between his legs, a magnificent shirt collar, of several inches in height, rising round his good-humored sallow face, and above it a cocked hat, that shone so, I thought it was made of polished tin, it may have been that oilskin, handsomely laced with black worsted, and ornamented with a shining gold cord. A little squat boat, rowed by three ragged galligos, came bouncing up to the ship. Into this Mr. Bundy and Her Majesty's Royal Mail embarked with much majesty, and in the twinkling of an eye, the Royal Standard of England, about the size of a pocket handkerchief, and at the bows of the boat, the man of war's pennant, being a strip of bunting considerably under the value of a farthing, streamed out. "They know that flag, sir," said the good-natured old tar, quite solemnly, in the evening afterwards. "Hey, respect it, sir. The authority of Her Majesty's lieutenant on board the steamer is stated to be so tremendous, that he may order it to stop, to move, to go larboard, starboard, or what he will, and the captain dare only disobey him suo periculo." It was agreed that a party of us should land for half an hour and taste real Spanish chocolate on Spanish ground. We followed Lieutenant Bundy, but humbly in the Provider's boat, that officer going on shore to purchase fresh eggs, milk for tea in place of the slimy substitute of whipped yolk of egg which we had been using for our morning and evening meals, and, if possible, oysters, for which it is said the rocks of Vigo are famous. It was low tide, and the boat could not get up to the dry shore. Hence it was necessary to take advantage of the offers of sundry galligos, who rushed barelegged into the water, to land on their shoulders. The approved method seems to be, to sit upon one shoulder only, holding on by the porter's whiskers. And though some of our party were of the tallest and fattest men whereof our race is composed, and their living sedans exceedingly meager and small, yet all were landed without accident upon the juicy sand, and forthwith surrounded by a host of mendicants, screaming, "I say, sir! Penny, sir! I say, English! Tamires! Penny!" in all voices, from extreme youth to the most lousy and venerable old age. When it is said that these beggars were as ragged as those of Ireland, and still more voluble, the Irish traveler will be able to form an opinion of their capabilities. Through this crowd we passed up some steep rocky steps, through a little low gate, where, in a little guardhouse and barrack, a few dirty little sentinels were keeping a dirty little guard, and by low-roofed whitewashed houses, with balconies, and women in them, the very same women, with the very same head clothes, and yellow fans and eyes, at once sly and solemn, which Murillo painted, by a neat church into which we took a peep, and, finally, into the Plaza del Constitution, or grand place of the town, which may be about as big as that pleasing square, pump court, temple. We were taken to an inn, of which I forget the name, and were shown from one chamber and story to another, till we arrived at that apartment, where the real Spanish chocolate was finally to be served out. All these rooms were as clean as scrubbing and whitewash could make them, with simple French prints with Spanish titles on the walls, a few rickety half-finished articles of furniture, and, finally, an air of extremely respectable poverty. A jolly, black-eyed, yellow-shawled Dulcinea conducted us through the apartment, and provided us with the desired refreshment. Sounds of clarions drew our eyes to the Plaza of the Constitution. And, indeed, I had forgotten to say, that majestic square was filled with military, with exceedingly small firelocks, the men ludicrously young and diminutive for the most part, in a uniform at once cheap and tawdry, like those supplied to the warriors at Astley's, or from still humbler theatrical wardrobes. Indeed, the whole scene was just like that of a little theater. The houses curiously small, with arcades and balconies, out of which looked women apparently a great deal too big for the chambers they inhabited. The warriors were in ginghams, cottons, and tinsel. The officers had huge epaulets of sham silver lace drooping over their bosoms, and looked as if they were attired at a very small expense. Only the general, the Captain General, Pooch, they told us, was his name. I know not how 'tis written in Spanish, was well got up, with a smart hat, a real feather, huge stars glittering on his portly chest, and tights and boots of the first order. Presently, after a good deal of trumpeting, the little men marched off the place, Pooch and his staff coming into the very inn in which we were awaiting our chocolate. Then we had an opportunity of seeing some of the civilians of the town. Three or four ladies passed, with fan and mantle. To them came three or four dandies, dressed smartly in the French fashion, with strong Jewish physiognomies. There was one, a solemn lean fellow in black, with his collars extremely turned over, and holding before him a long ivory-tipped ebony cane, who tripped along the little place with a solemn smirk, which gave one an indescribable feeling of the truth of Il Blas, and of those delightful bachelors and licentiates who have appeared to us all in our dreams. In fact, we were but half an hour in this little queer Spanish town, and it appeared like a dream too, or a little show got up to amuse us. Boom! The gun fired at the end of the funny little entertainment. The women and the balconies, the beggars and the walking mirillos, Pooch and the little soldiers in tinsel, disappeared, and were shut up in their box again. Once more we were carried on the beggars' shoulders out off the shore, and we found ourselves again in the great stalwart roast beef world, the stout British steamer bearing out of the bay, whose purple waters had grown more purple. The sun had set by this time, and the moon above was twice as big and bright as our degenerate moons are. The provider had already returned with his fresh stores, and Bundy's tin hat was popped into its case, and he walking the deck of the packet denuded of tails. As we went out of the bay, occurred a little incident with which the great incidents of the day may be said to wind up. We saw before us a little vessel, tumbling, and plunging about in the dark waters of the bay, with a bright light beaming from the mast. It made for us at about a couple of miles from the town, and came close up, flouncing and bobbing in the very jaws of the paddle, which looked as if it would have seized and twirled round that little boat and its light, and destroyed them forever and ever. All the passengers, of course, came crowding to the ship's side to look at the bold little boat. I say, howled a man, I say, a word, I say, passagero, passagero, passagero. We were 200 yards ahead by this time. Go on, says the captain. You may stop if you like, says Lieutenant Bundy, exerting his tremendous responsibility. It is evident that the lieutenant has a soft heart, and felt for the poor devil in the boat who was howling so piteously, passagero. But the captain was resolute. His duty was not to take the man up. He was evidently an irregular customer, someone trying to escape, possibly. The lieutenant turned away, but did not make any further hints. The captain was right, but we all felt somehow disappointed, and looked back wistfully at the little boat, jumping up and down far astern now, the poor little light shining in vain, and the poor wretch within screaming out in the most heartrending accents a last faint desperate say, "Passagero, oh!" We all went down to tea rather melancholy, but the new milk, in the place of that abominable whipped egg, revived us again, and so ended the great events on board the Addie Mary Wood steamer, on the 25th August, 1844. Gutenberg edition. End of chapter.